time to start. So, I guess let me start by reminding you where we are. So there is this nice map of chapter 4, and I said, I think in advance, that not all of it will be covered, but at least the part that on the blackboard must be covered. So let's do the rest of it today, okay? So what we did last time was we showed that if a space is compact and T2, then it's normal, and also if it is metric, then it's normal. That was, these were the sort of medium difficulty things of yesterday, then the, of last class. Then the harder thing of last class was Urysohn's lemma, which proves, which says that if a space is T4, then it is T4.5. So two comments about it. First of all, we did it, so there is a check mark. There are several comments. So we did it, so there is a check mark next to it. Second, my apologies to Urysohn. I think last time I said that this is like many theorems in topology, and it's not due to him. That he was in the neighborhood, but somehow not quite. So that applies to Tikhonov and to a few other theorems, but not to Urysohn. I could not confirm this. So much as I could check Urysohn, the Urysohn's lemma really is due to Urysohn. So I apologize. Anyway, and finally, the content is, so here, this is the statement that you can separate two closed sets by two disjoint closed sets by two disjoint open sets. And this is the statement that if you have two closed sets, you can find a continuous real-valued function that would interpolate, and that would somehow be 0 on this one, 1 on that one, and increase from 0 to 1 in between. And this is sort of magic, because to the left of this Urysohn lemma, everything is general topology. Everything is set theoretic, open and closed sets, and no real numbers. And this property is all about real numbers. And it's a bit of a magic that without ever explicitly stating anything about real numbers, you can get a real number property. And that was what we did last time. That was Urysohn's lemma. Anyway, given Urysohn's lemma, you can restrict your attention to the case where one of the open sets is a point, a single point. Sorry, not given Urysohn's lemma. Once you are in a T4.5 space, you can restrict your attention to the case where one of the closed sets is a single point. And therefore, the space you get is what is called completely regular, or T3.5, which just means that given a point and a closed set, you can separate them with a function. So you can find a function which is 0 here and 1 here. Okay? And what I want to do today is to tell you that a space is T3.5 if and only if it is a subset of a cube. Sorry, a cube. So an interval raised to some power. So in particular, if you start from a compact space, it will follow that a space is compact if and only if it embeds in a cube. Sorry, not if and only. Well. Sorry. If a space is compact in T2, then it embeds in a cube. Being compact, the image must be compact also, so must be closed. Okay? And so, a space is compact in T2 if and only if it is a subset, a closed subset of a cube, and this generalizes the fact you know about Rn, about compact subsets of Rn. anyway, that's the main goal for today. If we will have time, we'll also continue and do something about Titzel's theorem, but let's do it later. Let's talk about it later. Before doing this, let me note that we also show, by tracing the same list of implications, that every metric space embeds in a cube. So every metric space is a subspace of some cube. This sort of, so you know, the upper branch is philosophically nice, the lower branch is philosophically disturbing. Because, you see, the definition of the metric involves the real numbers to start with. So it should be wasteful to go through T4 and forget the real numbers, and then through Urison and work hard to reintroduce them, and then get the embedding into a cube. Okay, so you know, the top line is nice, and the bottom line is philosophically disturbing, and therefore I leave it as a challenge to you. So challenge, the challenge to me is to spell the word challenge. It's challenge, and I can never remember if it's an A or an E here. E. I always get it wrong. Always. Anyway, so the challenge to you is to show that a metric is a subset of a cube, that metric implies, embeds in a cube, bypassing, so without ever using Urison's lemma. And of course it will be much easier than the long way. Okay? Now you'll have a little bit of, I don't recall seeing it in the book, so you'll have to think. Okay. Before I actually start, read along is chapter 38 about completely regular spaces, though it's sort of mixed with other stuff. Not all of it is absolutely necessary. And chapter 35 about Titzel's theorem, if we actually get there. Okay, and finally, riddle along. So, can somebody explain to me, tell me what this configuration space is? Again, you remember the problem, right? If you have a machine made out of joints and rods of fixed length, and it's anchored at the ends, then a state of this machine is a point in R to the 6, because you need a point in R2 to describe this point, a point in R2 to describe this point, a point in R2 to describe this point, and these three points taken together completely describe a state of the machine. So a state of the machine is a subset of R6, except of course these points have to be, the distance from here to here has to be fixed, the length of the rod. So it's a genuine, a proper subset of R to the 6, and my question is, which topological space is it? Now, we've determined that if you have a shorter worm of lengths only 3, the result was a circle, even though it's a subset of R4, but topologically it's a circle. So which one is, what subset is this one? Yes?
Two-dimensional sphere?
Correct. Why?
I would think of it as like from one fixed point to Z2 on that, you would attach a rod and then that would be a circle. And for each, and you can stretch that rod in, or you get two circles. Because you can have it go up or go down.
I guess your extended argument is if you fix Z3 as a fixed point, the other two form a circle as before, right?
Yes.
So each point is associated with the circle except for the max extension either way, right?
Right.
So it's
yes. Yeah, so I like tell you your name?
Ian.
Ian.
Yeah.
So I like Ian's solution. So let me tell you what Ian is saying. Ian is saying, let's, as a preliminary step, put an extra anchor here. If you put an extra anchor here, the freedom of motion that you have is a circle. So you get a circle. Now let's start moving this anchor around. For different position of the anchor, you'll get for each position of the anchor, you'll get a circle. So you get sort of a stack of circles. One circle for each location of the anchor. The anchor can go on a certain interval. Well, really, it's an arc. But the arc is just the same as an interval. Okay? So it looks like the end result is a cylinder, right? A circle cross an arc. Except at the very top and at the very bottom, the left part is completely tight, right? If you anchor this point at the maximal point it can reach, by definition, this is what makes it the maximal point it can reach, the left part would be totally tight, so you'll only have a point here. And likewise, down at the bottom, you only get a point. So it's not really a cylinder, it is a cylinder that is clamped on both ends, and a cylinder that is clamped on both ends, topologically, is a sphere. It's the same as a sphere. Now, this is a riddle. It's an informal part of class. I'm not going to give you the formal parameterization or the formal function that shows you the homomorphism between the two. If you want, you can work it out on your own. Okay? So again, the answer is so this one, the answer is a sphere. And then my question is, what happens is if your worm is a bit longer, okay, so if it has five rods, and that should be easy, okay? Probably some of you, those who thought about this one before, already know the solution for that one. It's a simple extension. But this one is a bit harder. So this is an invalid spider. Okay, take a spider with only three legs. And the question is clear, right? You have four points that determine the state, and then you have some equalities of distances. Four points means that it's a subspace, a subset of R to the 8. And the question is, which one is it? Okay? Good. So we're done with the asides, and we can start with class material. So first of all, so again, I'm on my way to understanding completely regular spaces, so spaces which are T3.5, and I want to state the T3.5 property in a slightly different way, that makes it completely clear that it's about real valued functions. Okay? So a proposition, a topological space X is T3.5 if and only if the following collection is a basis for the topology of X. Now let me tell you what the collection is. So the collection is, well, first of all, start from a function f, which goes from X to, well, it doesn't really matter if you take the interval or the real numbers, but let's take the real numbers just for this purpose. And of course, if I say a function, I mean continuous. Okay? Now, for each such function, this function has the the set of places where it is equal to zero. Right? And likewise, it has the set of places where it is not equal to zero. So let me define in general, or just as a short notation, when I write f not equals to zero in brackets, I mean the set of all places x where f of x is not equal to zero. And I'll use this notation repeatedly later with different conditions placed here. So, you know, maybe I'll write occasionally f greater than g, again, with brackets, and this will just mean the collection of all x's so that f of x is greater than g of x. Okay? So anyway, this set, a different way of writing it, it's the inverse image of R minus the point zero. R minus the point zero is open, so the inverse image via a continuous function is open. Okay? So this set is always open. So let's put it over here. And then my proposition says that a space is completely regular if and only if the collection of sets in which a function doesn't vanish is a basis for the topology. You know, this is one place where if we had started with closed sets, it would have been a bit nicer, because then I could say the collection of all sets of the form where a function vanishes, which is sort of less of negations in a sentence, well, that collection is a basis for the closed sets. Except we didn't define what a basis for the closed sets is, so I don't want to, of course it can be done, but I don't want to go and waste time on that. Okay? Anyway, again, what is the content of this proposition? The content is that you can see the topology using real-valued functions. Right? Real-valued functions tell you everything about the topology. You get a basis for the topology simply by looking at real-valued functions. Okay. Good. So, proof. I guess let's start. Which direction is easier? So, maybe I'll start by saying something different. So, wait. Sorry. Once again, I'm confused. So, you know, let's just choose a direction in random. So, if, okay, so suppose x is t3.5, I need to show that this collection is a basis. Let U inside X be open, and well, I need to show that every point in U has a basic set around it. Okay, has a basic neighborhood inside U. Okay, so let U be open, and let X be some point in U. So the picture is, here is U, and we have a point X. So U is open, but I can separate X from the complement of U. The complement of U is closed. Okay? So by the property T3.5, I can find a function f going from our space x into the reals such that f of x is equal to 1 and f of u complement is equal to 0. Sorry, I want the opposite. F of x is equal to 0 and f of u complement is equal to 1. Okay? And then the set of all places where f is not equal to 0 is first of all in our collection. So, you know, if I call the collection B, then it's in that collection. Secondly, the point X is inside. Sorry, I went to the opposite. Sorry again. So, the point X is inside this basic set because by definition, well, because f of x is not equal to 0. So x is in here. And finally, well, since every point in the complement of u gets mapped to 0, the set of points where f is non-zero must be a part of u. Okay? So this is a subset of U. And we're done. Okay? So, okay. So now let's do the other direction.
Sir?
Yes?
Isn't that only sufficient to show that the basis, that particular basis generates that particular basis generates U, but don't you have to check that there are no others? There's no sets besides the open sets in X that are generated by that basis?
So of course you have to also check that every basis element is open. Right, you must know that the sets of the bases themselves are open. But this we already know. This I already said. Okay? So now the other direction. So I now know that this is a basis. I need to show that the space is T3.5. So suppose A inside X is closed and X is not inside A. So the picture is somehow the complementary to this one. Here is A and here is a point X and I want to separate them. Okay? So, well, if I want to talk about the basis of the open sets, I'd better have, to use something about the basis, I'd better have an open set around, so that would be the complement of A. So let U be A complement. And since I am given that this is a basis, I know that I can find a basic set containing X and inside U. Okay? So I know that I can find some basic set here. So, by the fact that calligraphic B, is a basis, I mean, I can find some function F such that the set of points where f is not equal to 0 So that's the basic set, contains X and is contained in the complement of A, in A complement. Okay? F of A complement, so again, if the places where F is not zero is in the complement of A, then in, on A, F is equal to zero. So F of A complement is equal to zero, and F of X, well, since F of, well, F belongs to the places where F is non-zero, so F of X is not equal to zero. If it's not equal to zero, it is equal to some constant. Let's call this constant C, and again, this constant C is not equal to zero. Now, to be T 3.5, I wanted F of X to be 1. So what do I do? What?
You just multiply by the inverse of F of X in order to get a new...
Right, or in other words, I divide by C. So finally set, so sorry, I'll put it here so that it fits in one blackboard. Can you read this? Should I, you know what? No. Let me just start a new blackboard. So finally, it's a new function, so let f prime of x be f of x divided by c, and f prime of x is still 0 on a complement.
What am I doing?
On A. Sorry. So it's still 0 on A, and now it's 1 on. So F prime of A is still 0, and F prime of X, this is not derivative, right? We're not in calculus, is equal to 1. If you want to be very, very particular, you may remember that when I defined completely regular, the definition was that you can find a function into the interval. This is not a function into the interval, as stated. This is a real-valued function. It could even be unbounded. So what do I do? What?
Cut it off.
Right, so, you know, if you have an unbounded function and you choose a place where to cut it, then the cutoff is still continuous. So that would do. So to be perfectly fair, I have to say here the maximum between 0 and this, so as to cut off the negative numbers, and then take the minimum of this and 1 so as to cut off values greater than 1. It does not change these two properties, but now the function is valued in the interval. Okay. Sorry. So, I guess you know what? Maybe it's time to go to the fun part of this class. So I'm on my way to showing that X is T3.5 if and only if you can think of X as if it is a subset of a cube. So what do I mean by this? I mean if and not, so this means F embeds in a cube, and I think the word embedding was used many times in the book, so you must have seen it many times before, but in case you didn't, let me make it explicitly, meaning there exists some continuous way of putting F into the cube, so there exists some continuous one-to-one function phi going from X into this cube, so that the topology of the image of phi is the same as the topology of X. So in other words, such that phi, regarded as a function going from X into phi of X. So if you ignore the rest of the cube, if you only think of the image, then it is a homeomorphism. Or, again said differently, what's a homeomorphism? Homeomorphism is a continuous function, so it's continuous to start with, which is invertible. Well, this function is certainly invertible because it's onto, because I just restricted the image to be in the range of the function, and it's one-to-one. So the only thing that remains is to show that the inverse is continuous. Now, the inverse is continuous, so when is a function continuous? A function is continuous if it carries an open set from here to an open set here. So when would the inverse be continuous? If it carries an open set here to an open set here. So the condition remaining to being a homeomorphism, given that I wrote all of this, is that phi will carry open set to open sets, such that i.e., phi as a phi of u is open in phi of x when u is open in x. Sorry. I promised to get to the fun part, but that was still a preliminary. So now is the fun part. So how on earth would you map a space which looks bizarre and insane? So this is X. Sorry, you know, on a blackboard you can only write two-dimensional spaces, so there is a limit to how bizarre and insane it can be. But how on earth are you going to map it into a cube? So let's start by trying to map it into R2. Okay? So how would you map into a space into R2? Well, you need to find the x coordinate of the result and the y coordinate of the result. So you need to find two continuous functions on x that somehow will parameterize all points of x, right? So you need to find some function f, I don't know, maybe these would be the level sets of the function f. So this is where f is equal to 0, this is where f is equal to 0.1, this is where f is equal to 0.2, and so on. And then you need to find, if you know the value of f, you don't yet know where you are, but at least you know on which of these lines you are. Okay? And then you need to find another function, g, so that these are the level sets of g. So this is g is equal to 0, this is g is equal to 0.1, and so on. So that the function x goes to, sorry, so now the function x goes to f of x, g of x, determines your point. Right? Because if you know where what f is, and if you know what g is, then you know where you are. Except what I did was completely heuristic. It covers only a part of my space. And only if my space happened to be placed on the blackboard and everything could be done two-dimensionally. In general, how would I find coordinate functions? How would I find, or which functions, okay, so suppose now I wanted to go into R to the A. So instead of just two coordinate functions, I need a worth of coordinate functions. Okay, or I'll need a many coordinate functions. But which functions should I use as these coordinate functions? Right, the idea would be to take the map, which is the product of f sub a, where a runs over a. So I need to find those functions f sub a, which would be my coordinate functions. So which functions should I take as coordinate functions? Yes?
Would b be the correct choice here? It seems a bit large, but...
b?
As in the set of...
But there is an even more succinct way of saying which coordinate functions should I take? Which functions should I take as my coordinate functions? All of them. Since I have no way to prefer, you know, on a general topological space, since I have no way of preferring one set of coordinates over another, why don't I just take all of them? And this is exactly what we're going to do. So the cube is going to be huge. The dimension of the cube will be, or the set parameterizing the cube will be the set of all continuous functions on my space. Okay. Now, there is a slight sort of limitations, change, whatever. You know, I actually want my cube to be the interval to some power a. So instead of looking at functions into the R, into the reals, I will look at functions into the intervals. But otherwise, it's the exact same thing. So in other words, now let's make it formal. So given some X, topological space X, in fact, it doesn't need to be completely regular. It doesn't need to be T3.5. Given X, let's call it C sub X. Or you know what, let's call it, so that I don't have to write calligraphic C all the time, let's just write C, ordinary C of X, to be, let this be what is often denoted in this way, so C of X and I, the collection of all continuous functions from X to up to I. So in other words, this is the set of all F going from x to I, which is continuous. Okay? Then I can define a map phi going from x into the cube whose coordinates are these functions. So into I to the c of x by, well, you see, I can write it in several ways. I can say phi is simply the product function whose coordinates are all of those functions. So it's the product over all functions f in C of f itself. Alternatively, I could say the f coordinate of phi is f itself. So this is the same statement. Alternatively, I could write explicitly phi at the point x. If you want the coordinate, the f coordinate of that, you take it to be simply the function f at the point, at the relevant point, at the point x. So all of these are different ways of writing the same thing. Now, we've seen this before. This is exactly what we did when we looked at the Stoneczek compactification of the integers. The reason I did not precede the Stoneczek compactification of the integers with this philosophical discussion is because if you wanted to embed the integers inside a cube, there are much simpler ways to do it. Okay? So somehow, going through this philosophical discussion was pointless. But for a general topological space, this is essentially the only thing you can do. Yes?
Just one little question. For this to work out, all of topology probably has to be product. Or at least
always, the topology on a product is always the product topology. Okay. It remains to show that it works. This construction can be made always. Whenever you have a topological space, you can write the function phi. It doesn't mean it will be one-to-one. It doesn't mean it will be in embedding. It doesn't mean anything. But you can always write this function. So, theorem, phi is an embedding if and only if x is t3.5. Okay? So if x is t3.5, this thing works. Okay, the easy direction is this one, and it's so easy that I'll postpone it to the end, and if we don't have time, I'll keep it as an exercise. The hard direction is this one, and it's also easy, but let's do it anyway. Okay? So, first of all, I claim that phi is one-to-one. Can somebody give me a hint?
You could set one coordinate where the point goes to one and then the other ones where it doesn't. So you could fix.
Yes, exactly. Well, what does it mean? I mean, how do I show that this is one-to-one? Well, if I have two points in my space, x and y, and they're different, if they were equal, then I don't need to show anything. But if I have two different points in the space, I need to show that some coordinate function has a different value on x than on y. But what are my allowed coordinate functions? Well, all of them. Okay? So pick a function which is different on x and in y, and on that coordinate, the image would be different, and therefore the image is one-to-one. So let's write it. First of all, phi is 1-to-1. Oh, sorry, maybe even before that, why is phi continuous? It's continuous because it's a product of continuous functions, and that was the definition of the product topology. Okay, this said, why is it 1-to-1? Well, if x different than y are both points in x, use t3.5 to find a function f going from x into the unit interval such that f of x is equal to 0 and f of y is equal to 1. And of course this is possible because when we define t3.5, we also insisted that it would be T1, So single points are closed, so you just need to separate the point X from the closed set Y. Okay? And then phi of X, the F coordinate of it, is different than phi of Y, the F coordinate of it, because the F coordinate is F of X, and the F coordinate here is F of Y, and F of X is different than F of Y. But if you have one coordinate different, the points are different. So phi of X is different than phi of Y. So it remains to show that that phi is open. The only thing that remains is to show that phi of u is open if u is open in X. So next, let u be a basic open set, and of course it's enough to restrict your attention to basic open sets, because if you know that the image of a basic open set is open, then the union of the images will be the image of the unions, and the image of the union will be the union of the images, and so any union of basic open sets will go to an open set, and you're done. So it's enough to show that if U is a basic open set, then phi of U is open. Now, what's a basic open set? It's some set of the form F is not equal to 0 for some function. Okay? Now, I admit that before, when I talked about those functions, they were real valued, but you can do the same trick as before and chop it, and may as well assume that F is a function into the interval. Okay? So F is in fact one of our coordinates. So then, phi of u is just phi of this set. It's just phi of all the places where F is not equal to 0. And I claim that this is the same as phi of X intersect the set of all points where the F coordinate is not equal to 0. So the set of all points where the F coordinate is meaning the inverse image of the set R, or well, the unit interval, so well, you know what, let's just write it as R minus 0, even though I really just care about the unit interval. I don't know why I'm not being precise. The unit interval minus 0. Okay? So first of all,
should that be the inverse projection?
The inverse, of course. Thanks. So first of all, phi of I need to show two inclusions. So phi of u is certainly contained in phi of x, and it's also contained in the places where the F coordinate is non-zero. So this inclusion is done. So this one is easy. And this one is, well, suppose you had a point here. Then it's in phi of x. So it's phi of some specific point x. When is phi of x inside here? If its F coordinate, so if and only if its F coordinate evaluated at, well, sorry, it's f, no, just its f coordinate is not equal to zero. Right? A point is here if and only if its f coordinate is not, well, is not equal to zero. This is the meaning of this inverse projection. But this is just f of x. But our point x was a point satisfying this. So therefore our point x is a point in which f of x is not equal to zero, so it's here. So we're done. Okay? But the equation written here just means that phi of u is open in phi of x because it's the intersection of phi of x with an open set. Okay? So phi of u is open in phi of x, and we're done with the hard part. The easy part, so I mean, I think I don't have time to do it, but I'll just state it. Well, if phi is an embedding, then x has the same topology as a subset of a cube, and it's easy to show that any subset of a cube is completely regular. So, in fact, it follows from two exercises, I think, that you got. So, a subset of a completely regular set is completely regular, and the product of completely regular set is completely regular. So, I'll make sure that these exercises were assigned. If they were not, I will either go back to it or assign them for next time. So, thank you.